A heartfelt welcome back to our loyal listeners and a shy hello to any new pair of ears to the first episode of Reject and Resubmit, a podcast formerly known as Desk Reject Der PhD Cast. With you on the ones and twos today, our assistant professor Philip Becker, all the way from Utrecht.
Hi.
Assistant professor Marco Leander Rapp from Amsterdam.
Guten Abend.
And myself, Alexander Staub, broadcasting to you from Barcelona. A new team of hosts means we will also be introducing a completely new revolutionary format where each week, each one of us will bring a topic of discussion around academia, life, and theory. And beyond that, we will be kicking things off today with, of course, the main part of every episode. Today, I would like to know what are things that really just ruin your day? Like the small things that matter. In particular, I'd like to know what are some things that annoy you to an irrational extent? Like when Philip starts hyperventilating when you tell him that socialism doesn't work. Things like that.
Your information about my political stance is, I think, three to 5 years old.
Oh, you finally seen the light. I'm very happy to hear.
I will not comment on it. What drives me nuts? I would say if people say pronounce words in English wrong, but so consistently that within, for example, German speaking community, it became the new word. Hypothesis. Stuff like that. I think it is super annoying to correct people because I think many believe that this is actually how it is pronounced, are very advanced in their career, and I do not want to be the person after 10 to 15 years within academia to tell them that it's not the right pronunciation. But it always, let's say, grinds my gears a little bit.
That's so funny, you know, because I already thought of the next discussion topic. And it was going to be language related, like what are things people say that annoy you? And I was going to say the thing that really, really pisses me off is when people correct things that are just some obscure grammatical error, but everybody knows what you mean. Like if I tell you like, hey, yeah, can you grab this for me? And you go, I don't know, can I? And I just want to drop kick them in the face.
Yeah, but that's different, right? That's an idiom. You know that this is how it is used, but hypothesis is just not how it is pronounced in the language.
Similia is one that I had heard quite a lot.
There are a few. On the other hand, I find it charming if people rely on their native accent a little bit.
Marco, what about you?
Yeah, honestly, for me, it's more about the rather mundane things in life. So I usually start my day by grinding coffee. And if I forgot to charge the scale that I use to weigh the coffee, and it has like this 3-bar power indication. Yeah. And I always know it's the last bar, I'm on the edge. And when the day comes, I'm always, oh, you're such an idiot. Like, why do you hate yourself so much? And this is usually a moment of despair that I can hardly overcome, because then I'm pretty sure that my coffee will not be as good as it used to be, as I'm very bad in intuitively weighing things.
That is such a 30-plus-year-old white boy hobby. That's like, for anybody that doesn't know what we look like and only listens to us, you have now a perfect picture of Marco, no matter what you imagine.
Says the guy who speaks into a microphone and hosts a podcast of three guys.
Of the white boy things to do. This is we're just collecting all the stamps in our book. For me, it's, and I don't know why, but it's, and it doesn't happen, thank God, that much anymore. It's when I walk, I'm in a rush, and I walk out the door, and something catches in the door handle. Like it used to be corded headphones. Now, sometimes it might be like it really happens rarely, but it might be my backpack or my sleeve. But I would go into a rage and just absolutely want to destroy that door's life and all its family members. It was I don't know why, it just enraged. It feels like, you know, it feels like someone at a bar is just yanking you as you're exiting. It's like, it's just really to a really unreasonable degree makes me extremely angry, and I just want to hurt that inanimate object so badly.
How long do you carry that anger with you?
It's like brief and scary. Like I turn into like a half a second. Yeah, exactly. I just turn green and just completely, you know, lose my temper, and then I calm down and I kind of, you know, my soul enters back into my body again. But it's scary.
After
like I scare
brief
myself.
48 hours.
Yeah, exactly. I wake up naked in a different city.
In a cornfield.
Covered in blood, and then it's
doors all around you.
Exactly. Just splinters, wood splinters in my mouth. Okay. Now that we've covered the main topic, we can dive into the side topics, the short rest of the episode. And I'm just going to decide that we'll start with Philip.
Thank you.
What's your topic? What's the name of your topic? What are we doing today, and what's the topic?
Yeah, so I start with a lighthearted topic in the category of life. So we want to talk a little bit of how life intersects with our work, and one drips into the other. And one thing that happened to me, it's a bit of a let's say a more challenging topic, is what happens if life events surrounding work that are challenging, for example, death of a family member, or someone has to take over care work. How do we deal with that? So I had last semester multiple situations where parents or students died. Obviously, there was a very, I don't know why, but actually, literally multiple. And I felt a little bit overwhelmed, because on the one hand, I was very happy that they shared that with me. On the other hand, I had to support them a little bit, at least in the role that I had as their teacher. But they also obviously missed deadlines, and I had to uphold the rules of the system a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I found that challenging a little bit to remain fair to the system, but also help them obviously in the small capacity that I have. So how do you think about that? What's our responsibility in such a situation? And should we try to separate that clearly from us, from them? How can we help if someone, either as a student or as a colleague, goes through one of these more challenging life events?
I mean, it's
Marco or Alex.
Oh, yeah? Sorry. No. Marco, please save me before I say something stupid.
Let's ask the psychologist first.
Good idea. Yeah. Honestly, I think it's also important not to overstep boundaries, and not over, and also professional boundaries in many regards. So last year, a student of mine died, and this was a big shock to me and to everyone in the course. And I spent a great deal, meaning at least 4 or 5 days, deliberating what to do and what's best to do. And first and foremost, I felt like saying nothing is not the right thing. However, I'm not a therapist, although I have a background in psychology. This is a super field that I have zero to none clue about. To me, it was like all about open communication, and then pointing them towards support structures that universities usually have in place. And to be fair, I pre-tested things just to be sure that I can also make a claim that you will be helped. So I kind of logged in and clicked my way through this rather tedious clicking scheme. But then in 5 to 10 minutes, I could call someone directly. And there I felt also comfortable telling the students, hey, if you actually want to talk to someone, this is the line and this is the place. And similarly to your case, Philip, I think, or at least in Amsterdam, I feel like every student has a student advisor, which is odd. Sometimes I feel like there are more student advisors than students. But usually they are the persons to kind of take care of these sorts of things. And yeah. I try my best to accommodate like all these issues. And I totally get that you also want to be fair to the system. Yeah. And in other instances, I totally get that too. And there, I guess it's also about open communication with the student. So, hey, I know it's a hard situation, but maybe focus on the situation then. Yeah. And I mean, we will figure things out in the next iteration of the course or to go for the reset. And there, I can only be kind of a friendly advisor. But yeah, I think that's basically my sentiment. So A, pointing towards the right direction, and B, being as transparent and open and approachable in these sorts of situations as I can be, without overstepping too many boundaries.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. I mean, it's like one of those, it's such an edge case. I wonder if there should be some kind of playbook beyond what you said, Marco. It's kind of like, just, you know, where is the line? And then, you know, be human about it. You know, it's I don't know, because it depends. I mean, there's that extreme situation, like one of your students passes away, which is terrible. And then there's a lot of gray areas, like between that, when like Philip, in his case, when like students come and say they've had a personal tragedy, and yeah, I think, I guess you just have to be sufficiently human, empathetic, and then, yeah, make sure you're not trying to offer, you know, any advice in terms of being their counsel or something. We here at DeSade, there's also there's not necessarily individual student counselors, but they implemented like a space where students can go to get free counseling. Which is really like set up, you know, like a university therapist or multiple of those, and I think that's really important. And in Manchester, they had counselors as well. And also, I know, I think, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's just personal, but I wonder how many students really could fall into this perception that you as a lecturer would even have that role of a counselor, right? Like me as a student, if something terrible happened in my life, I don't know that I would, you know, approach necessarily a lecturer and say, hey, please help me, in a way, like, I don't know how to deal with this. It would be more a matter of, look, something terrible happened to me. I'm dealing with it. Just think, you know, it would be great if there was, you know, some accommodations. But I wonder how many students really would make the quote unquote mistake to assume that you as a lecturer are also responsible for.
Yeah, I think as a maybe typical student in the classroom, this is less likely. But it might be that didn't happen to me, but I can imagine that maybe a colleague or a PhD student or even a colleague on the tenure track sees you a little bit as an emotional outlet, right? So to come to you and not drop, but share maybe too much of an emotional burden with you. Do you think that there's also a point where you can draw a line in the sand and tell a person this is kind of your issue to deal with? How would you deal with someone who oversteps a boundary in that direction?
It's so hard, because I'd want to, it's difficult because it's a colleague, right? You know, you don't want to tell him, you don't want to be like a robot and say, oh, that's terrible, here's a phone number you can call. But yeah, I mean,
remain tricky. Human, yeah.
that's a good advice. Yeah. Kind of, yeah, it's really, yeah, that's a tough one. It's never happened. If it happened, it usually was with colleagues or somebody where already the friendship basis was established. And then I guess, like, if it's beyond that, There was a situation where a colleague kind of opened up to me about a situation, and I don't know, but like I felt because it's a colleague, I would adopt more of a, you know, friend's perspective because that's what the person needed right now. I don't know. However, I didn't plan long term if that would have gone wrong. You know, I didn't plan in the sense of, oh no, what if I'm quote unquote too supportive right now and all of a sudden this person, you know, thinks I'm some kind of like we've got this relationship established now. Luckily didn't get that far. Luckily for all of us, this person, you know, was just appreciative for the support and that was it. But it could have gone other ways as well. And I just didn't consider that. It was more a spur of the moment thing. So that's a tough one. PhD students especially, I think, where's this weird kind of
dependency in certain what so, I want to share is one more advice is that it can go off a little bit when you rely on email communication. So a student of mine shared I have to share the story. I tried to make it as general as possible. Someone shared that a family member passed away. And the email was very short and very neutral. So I assumed that it was someone more distant to the student and also replied in a similar neutral fashion, informing the student that there are no special accommodations that can be made. And due to the fact that someone did not show up to a testing event, the person also failed. And the student was really mad with me. And it also stirred up a few waves with also student advisors got involved and so on and so forth. And the student felt deeply hurt by the lack of my empathy. And to be honest, I can totally understand it because it was a very close family member.
Yeah.
So I completely misinterpreted the communication in a sense. And I think the student expected way more understanding from my side, but I was unable to, I don't know, provide that based on the information or how I perceived his or her email. So what I can share as a sentiment is to be a little bit careful when emails come in because there can be a lot of emotion under the hood that is hard to read in the email, right? And then to respond on the level of empathy needed in the situation.
Would you say it would have been better to like just, you know, tell them to, you know, talk about this in person?
I think I would not have made the mistake if he or she spoke to me directly.
No, I mean, like, would it have been better to just like reply, hey, you know,
let's,
you want to have a quick like let's discuss this, I don't know, via call or something?
I think that would have been more effective, but on the other hand, I felt like a very standard email of a student trying to make a
case.
So
just like, okay, I get it.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's one takeaway for me.
But I also think these kind of instances are becoming more and more frequent, especially also within our more or less newer job role as a at least the institutions I or we transfer to are more international than BU back in the days, right? So you have a lot of international students that don't have too many contacts within the country. So I feel like, especially for them, it's quite, or they are way more likely to overshare and to also seek such advice from someone. And the same applies to obviously fellow colleagues who just moved to the Netherlands or who are foreigners as well. And they're seek some, I guess, solidarity in a sense. So, something that at least I have never experienced before in this frequency.
Yeah, and more opportunities for cultural disconnects concerning how much openness and empathy and support is expected, right? So,
I was just thinking, like, I think the colleague level of things. I guess you just, you know, provide as much support as the person needs.
I think so too. Yeah.
I think the trying to think through, okay, where's the line here? I mean, given also what Marco said, you know, you don't know, this person may not really have anybody right now, just needs some support. I don't think it's something you should worry about, oh, am I overstepping a line? It could be, but I feel like the right response would be to be as empathetic and as supportive as possible in a first interaction and then kind of evaluate, oh, is this turning into a dynamic which maybe I don't want, and I should steer in a way to make it clear, like, I'm not a therapist. The trickier things, I think, are more like student or even, you know, supervisory roles, where it's probably best to draw the lines in a way that still maintains empathy, but it's like clear, look, this is not a support relationship that can work.
So to conclude, we give the absolute outlandish recommendation to try to be a good person.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. This is what you tune in for, to just get these
follow
completely left field. And what a wonderful topic to start off the first episode.
Thank you. Thank you.
Great work.
I think I hand it to the topic of theory, which is, I think, Alex. Is that you?
How dare you assume that you're allowed to hand anything?
Who made you the host, you, by the way?
The podcast godfather. Yes, okay, yeah, I'll take that. And now, from what I was wondering, so my topic is what we term in this podcast a theory topic, where it's more related to the research area of our lives. And I was wondering, and I'd like to get your feedback on this, whether you think, or what's your opinion on that every, let's say, good or you should aim in your research for something surprising or something that is not intuitive. And I'm asking because I every now and then I go back to this article from Davis. Believe it or not, I sometimes read an article, and it's the this is interesting article. And I feel like a lot of kind of advice that is taken from that boils down to one or two of the 16 or 20 or whatever how many ways is described in there how to make, you know, an interesting article. This aspect of unintuitiveness, kind of establishing something where the common belief is one way and your research has to show that it's not that way. That's not necessarily doing the article justice, but at least that's the way I kind of feel like a lot of it is boiled down to or interpreted to is this, okay, you have to try and make your research a little more, you know, surprising. What's the non-intuitive thing about this? What do you think? Is that the right approach? And everything you do, kind of your aim should be, you know, when you're working on your work, is like there has to be some nugget, something in there which makes people kind of feel like you've got a surprising finding.
Yeah, I think that there are two different perspectives to think about research in a sense, right? So you can either have this Hegelian dialectic perspective of thesis, antithesis, right? And then we try to get to some new place through a synthesis. This is, I think, where we are right now. And this is why we try to see one argument and then try to topple this argument or try to disprove this argument in the hope that this leads us to new knowledge. Mm-hmm. But there's a completely different perspective, and this is more like this Bayesian updating, right? But I think in a world where research is so abundant and the world is so noisy, I think it just feels more intuitive for humans to do this dialectic thing, right? Where someone argues A and someone argues B. So, I just wanted to quickly for myself also contrast these two perspectives. I think the more Bayesian approach would be more successful overall, but I think it is deeply embedded in how we do research that we have this thesis, antithesis, synthesis thinking. I think this is how I would start. Marco, are you Hegelian or are you Bayesian?
I think...
This is a question I try to avoid. This is a question I rather would prefer to avoid. But I mean, I overall the this what you said really resonates. But I don't know. I'm always kind of also annoyed by reading these papers with 7 hypotheses. All of them are confirmed. I'm like, yeah, okay, nice. So something surprising is always a good thing. It doesn't need to be, and surprising or new can be also, I mean, in the reader's eye in many regards, right? That a new measure works is not surprising, but it's might be surprising to read that there is a new measure for something like that. So I don't know, the other day, my colleague introduced me to a measure of policy gaslighting. I never thought intrigued. I would need such a measure. I thought it is nice and it's interesting. And because, yeah, about how, I mean, things like, I don't know, flexibility usually are kind of, yeah, formalized in a policy. However, this policy is not equally enforced across departments, right? Or sometimes even within a department, differently enforced on an employee level. And I think having this concept and being able to measure it is nice. It's interesting. So it's not super novel because, I mean, it could be something related to manipulation, right? It could be something related to persuasion. It could be something related to discrimination. But it is still interesting. And it helps me think about the world in a different way. And I think that is what I at least strive or aim for.
But aren't we hamstringing ourselves? I'm just going to try and push this point. Like, aren't we hamstringing in general research if this is our... if this is our guiding light, like if we decide, also like we, I'm not even talking about like us as producers, but if this is a guiding light of like the top journals, you know, because we're also in a time maybe where at the same time that we want more interesting research, there's also people yelling about research not being reproduced, and this quest for, you know, something surprising leads to p-hacking, leads to people shelving a lot of research where it's like, oh, you know, well, I don't know, there's zero findings or the findings that they have aren't interesting enough, for example. I mean, even in my projects, I get caught up in discussions where it's like, yeah, I mean, these are the findings, but like, yeah, isn't that too close to what we know already? And then immediately you have to go on a quest for digging through the data and figuring out, okay, well, how can we either frame this or find something where we can say, oh, this is, you know, you didn't expect that. Do you agree that this can be a problem, or do you think, well, you know, it's not really, and we should aim... it's a good thing to aim for surprising and just let the other research, you know, be published elsewhere in non-prestigious journals.
I think the question a little bit is what is the research performance that you aim for, right? Do you want to have a cumulative body of knowledge that collectively is extremely powerful, or do you want to have one idea that individually has a lot of potential, right? And I think going back to this idea of Bayesian updating, we have priors and we get closer to something that we could call truth. I think it's extremely powerful as a body of knowledge. Maybe one example where this was extremely successful is physics in the early 20th century, where really one building stone built on another and they really collectively built a very strong body of knowledge. Mm-hmm. But I think in social sciences, this is not really how it works, right? What we provide is the nugget of this is interesting, one tool that sticks out that helps a manager, an agent, a policymaker to make one kind of decision more effectively, right? So this notion of a collective body of knowledge, I would argue, is less important in social science. And this is also why we opt so much for this is interesting, in order to stick out of the vastness of
what makes research. You say that? Like, what? Where the hell is this assumption coming from that social sciences doesn't need a cumulative body of knowledge? I could just as easily say it's a huge crux that we kind of treat social science research as one idea at a time. I would maybe even go as far as that is what brought us to all this nudge and behavioral economics fetishization, where it's like, you know, just slap a fly on a urinal and you'll get 20% less splash, or just, you know, instead of telling people they're going to get fired, how about you call it, you know, personal development somewhere else? You know, I don't understand why you would claim such a thing.
I would say that, okay, I'm trying to make a case here. So social sciences looks at a very broad, messy construct, right, or reality of individuals working together, living together in a very messy system. So in order to find truths that somewhat hold, you have to hold a lot of things constant in order to look at something. And when you hold things constant, you can only look at a narrow subset or from a very narrow perspective onto the phenomena. And this alone fractures research on societies, on organizations, on firms, into very small different groups that try to hold things constant by assuming, for example, more rational behavior, or by looking not at the individual actor but at the whole market. And these different lenses just lead to naturally to a strong fracturing of the research. You can still argue that knowledge can be cumulative within any individual lens, but even there, then you again reach a point where someone wants to relax an assumption or wants to introduce something, and other stuff breaks down. So I think it's just in the nature of the many emergent elements within society that makes it so hard to build a coherent, cumulative body of knowledge.
I don't know. I mean, I really like, I'd like to challenge you more, but then I mean, like, I want to say that I don't know if the premise that social systems are so much more complex than, I don't know, some other system, and that's why we're chasing surprising rather than, let's call it, cumulative knowledge building. But I don't know, like, I can't really point to any other discipline and say, look, this is just as complex as a social system and they're, you know, pursuing cumulative rather than surprising knowledge. I don't know. I think just my hunches. I feel like it's maybe also part of the reason why we're quote unquote stuck in social sciences, is this idea of, you know, and it's not even, it's more, I think it's not a, it, the matter is that the big journals, at least in management, for example, they kind of fetishize this surprisingness, this unintuitiveness. And so everybody kind of chases this. We need a paper, or we need a research project that kind of stands on its own legs. You know, we mm-hmm. provide the new thing. But I don't know.
I would strongly disagree that we are stuck. I would just argue that it is in the nature of our research object that it is very hard to come to a point where knowledge is truly cumulative.
I mean, is this the case in psychology, Marco? Like, what, I mean, if do you have any, you know, like, we're looking at this from a perspective of management research, maybe a little bit of economics from my side, but also just like not really an expert. Do you agree with Philip? Or do you think, you know, this is not the case?
Well, I have to admit, I'm not fully immersed in the psychology discourse anymore. Having said that, or with this caveat ahead, I would A, not fully think that we are stuck. I think some ideas get further developed, get further refined, especially on a theoretical lens. Some methodological approaches mm-hmm. get way and way more sophisticated. And I know for a couple of things, or most of us know that some of the things we used to believe are just wrong. Like the infamous example with the fly in the toilet. So I think we still build upon each other. We still do hypothesis testing, right? So in this regard, I wouldn't say that we are fully stuck, and I wouldn't say that it's either or. Sometimes it's both, right? But again, having said that, if you want to publish something highly, having something super intriguingly new is some always... Yeah. Easier to sell than, I don't know, having, and I hate these papers myself too, having a structure equation model or a moderated mediation or doubly moderated mediation or whatever, because you like, how do you sell that to a practitioner, or how do you even make sense of a three-way interaction? So in this regard, yeah.
I mean, I think that what you brought up right now, this just this little nugget of, I still feel like we're kind of stuck in this, I'm going to say stuck again, but we're kind of wedged maybe or whatever in this schizophrenic situation where on the one hand we want to be relevant to practitioners, and on the other hand we want to be, you know, relevant to some kind of scholarly theory. And it's kind of trying to balance that tightrope, which I don't know, maybe other fields are a bit better at maneuvering, where there's clear, you know, going back, this is our first episode, but a point that I mentioned that we discussed about these managerial contributions, I think that brings me back again, this drive, we want to be surprised, we want to have, like, because practitioners are like goldfish and they don't care about what came before, so we need some kind of surprising, some insight, something that they can take the paper and run with. And I wonder, like, since we recorded that, I have not kind of perused many other fields to see if that's similar. But that's maybe something that is, I wouldn't be surprised if that is a lot of the driver of why, you know, this drive to produce surprising research in the top journals is kind of being pursued.
Definitely. And I mean, one of my dearest co-authors and friend, he's a sociologist, and he always says we are applied science. And every time we write together, I feel like his writing is so far off my comprehensibility, my understanding, and intellectual capabilities. But still, he writes down, yeah, it's super applied, and it's really far off the theoretical lens, and so on and so forth. So I guess, yeah, as managerial or being part of a business school, you always have this a more applied lens. We don't think about how social systems interact, or I don't know, how thinking within the human brain works. So having, yeah, and like a purpose in being kind of practitioner oriented in some regards, and even there the practitioners think we are the lunatics, so I think it is indeed a driver that makes it more difficult.
Alex, okay, Philip, a final quick question. Word. Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's more okay. Then I try. If we find it boring, I move on. But what would be research that is not interesting and still highly important to do, Alex?
Because, no. So I want to make. Okay, because my point wasn't the entire premise of the. That's interesting. I think research should be interesting, and I think interesting meaning, you know, it doesn't have to be interesting to the world, and I think that's not the point it's being made. It should be interesting to a particular field of researchers. I was just taking, you know, this one of the aspects to make something interesting is to make it surprising, and that was my premise. Is like, does every research have to be interesting? I think every, you know, I agree that it should be interesting in the sense of, you know, you shouldn't just be repeating. If you want to be published well, there's a place for that. But, you know, new and path breaking research should be interesting. It was more the surprising aspect of thing. Like, do you have to always think about if you want to publish well, let's say top journal, is it good that we have to always think about is this too intuitive, or can we like put up some kind of straw man? And then our findings are surprising in light of the straw man.
Yeah.
And to use this device all the time.
To play devil's advocate a little bit here. If your results are very intuitive, this also means that we know this on a latent level, right? So knowing all the stuff we know and then learning yours, having the feeling of intuitiveness, means that we can, through what we already know, somewhat infer what you show. So the surprising element has to be on a level that you have to convince me that we actually did not know, or you have to tell me that, I don't know, the way how you showed this is so novel that there is something interesting in something non-surprising. But to be honest, I think we're criticizing a deeply human phenomena, namely that something that we find surprising is interesting, right? That's otherwise the value of information would just be lower. I think it in a sense we're criticizing the manifestation of a deeply human characteristic in how research works, and I get the problem.
More about dopamine. Look into neuroscience.
Follow real researchers.
So now that we've found a definitive answer and we all agree apparently
when that happens.
Yeah. let's proceed to a topic which hopefully will spark a lot of controversy amongst each other and among our listeners. Marco, take us away.
Wonderful. I think this very nicely also resonates with what we just discussed. So in academia, usually we kind of skip the rather shallow topics, and I feel today's podcast is a very nice testament to that. this is something very nice, and that's also what basically brought me into the field of academia. However, you probably noticed that at conferences or in the breaks with the students and so on and so forth, you need to do some small talk. And I don't know whether it was to practice Dutch or because my small talk skills are very, very weak. But my co-worker unsolicitedly sent me a podcast about how to do small talk.
Wow. That's amazing.
I listened to it and
interesting person.
No, that was not the issue. And it was very interesting because the different cultures have different starting questions. So apparently in China, it's have you eaten is kind of a nice starter for a small talk conversation. However, I wanted to hear what you say or what you tell people if you have this kind of awkward situation. So students are in the classroom already and you stand there, your slides are prepared. And I feel like just standing there and embracing the void is not, at least it doesn't... to my natural, so I try to engage in a conversation or so. Or if you, I don't know, have this awkward Zoom calls and you are in a meeting with someone you don't know, but it's only the two or three of you, or you bump into someone at the conference coffee table and you are having this massive Stanley cup where you fill 1.5 ounces or 20 ounces of coffee in, and you want to make some lighthearted conversation to ease the tension that he is also waiting for coffee also, or she, and fearing that they might not get any because you will empty the bucket.
So what's the question?
At a conference.
What's your small talk to go to topic?
Okay.
At a conference, I invest the first 30 seconds aggressively staring at the badge to see what's the school the person is from.
You are from one free drink at the AOM reception.
To be honest, I think at conferences it is somewhat easy because everyone has this experience of the conference. So you can either complain about something that the coffee is too far away or too light or whatever. I think that helps a lot. With students, I struggle a bit more, to be honest, because there again, the question of optimal distance to the students is quite challenging to do. To be honest, with students, I somewhat avoid small talk. So either we talk about... Just stand there, look at
angry.
Them. Look at them. I have one of these, I have one of these paddles with a ball and a string attached to it.
I thought for a second you were going to speak about a very different paddle, and I'm glad it turned into one with
the string. Okay, I have no idea what you're talking about. Unfortunately, no idea what you're talking about. So I think with colleagues or with other academics, I think it's quite easy. I also enjoy these very slightly awkward conversations at conferences. With students, I struggle a bit more. So I'm happy to hear what are your favorite small talk topics, Alex, with students.
Oh, wow. With students. Well, I haven't interacted with students in a while.
Is there a reason?
What? Yeah, I'm not allowed to anymore.
It involves a court order.
It's a Baldock topic. I usually, I think I just point out usually something stupid that happened to me. I like to complain a lot. Surprise, surprise. Yeah. And probably that's something like I complain about something and see if that resonates. But as go-to small talk topic, I just don't care, really. You know, I just don't care enough anymore.
I remember the question that I asked the students, like a busy semester. That's a golden one.
What'd you do last weekend?
No. You don't do that. You ask the student, what did you do last weekend?
I don't know. Why not?
Do you have a boyfriend? Stuff like that. No. That's too personal.
What parties did you go to?
Yeah.
Okay, so far we have a lot of complaining about coffee, about conferences, about school year. Yeah.
I think it's also an invitation for them to start to complain. And they can say, definitely. Yeah, that's tough.
that's fine. Maybe I just always show up late to my classes.
That helps.
Life hack.
just be late and avoid small talk that way. I might honestly be quite comfortable with awkward silence, and that prompts others to instigate a conversation. That might be it. Like, I just wait for the question of, you know, nice weather, where are you from, or something. And then I go from there. I don't know. I don't mind awkward silence. It's kind of funny.
I also don't mind small talk, to be honest. And I would say I'm not too bad at it.
Do you have a particularly a bad small talk experience? What was the most where did you feel like you really shit the bed?
Yeah, I love it when you ask a question and then you get a one-word answer, and then you stand there, and then the problem is, what do you do? Like, do you ask a second question, awaiting another one-word answer? Do you wait until the other person now says something? And then I have to... So accepting the silence is one thing, but this is accepting the silence after a clear defeat. And that I don't like.
My worst ones are... like when the person has been introduced to me, or when I've known that person before, and I just ask something that is, and the response is then just like, yeah, I mean, I told you that, you know, or like, yeah, we already met. And then it's that just hits me in a way where I'm like, oh shit. Yes.
Yeah. But there's I usually know, for at least on behavior of the other person, you can kind of make an assessment whether they know you, right? And then ask the question, remind me again, where was the last time that we saw each other?
Yeah, but isn't that just as awkward if they're like,
In our age, I think we are too young to ask these sorts of questions.
Yeah, exactly. I want to go up to a full person. Remind me again. Where do you know me from?
Or just know me from the internet.
Yeah.
No, but you can do it in a way that it is friendly. When was the last time we saw each other again? Was it Toronto or something like that? Right? You can do it in a way. I mean, you kind of know what kind of more colleague it's not.
Right. But what if you do that twice?
Do we meet in person, or are you just one of my internet fans?
What if you do that twice to the same person? Like, the first time is like, oh, did we meet? Remind me, was that in Toronto where we met? And then you meet a half year later, and then it's like, did we meet in Toronto?
Alex, what is...
dementia.
Are you having a stroke? What is the alternative? that you
I don't have one. I think I just run head on into these situations and I'm just like, yeah, where are you from? It's like, yeah, man.
Yeah, see? But this, oh man, Alex, we spent like multiple days together, we became very close friends.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
No, those are the ones that really get me. Is where I'm like, yeah, I mean, we've seen each other like twice, and then I'm like, oh yeah, wait, oh yeah, I remember, and then I still don't, and then I'm just like struggling like shit because then I'm also stuck. I'm frozen. I'm like, okay, shit. The next question better not be worse than the first one. Like, what can I ask now without still not remembering this person that obviously remembers me?
Do you like soup?
Have you eaten already?
Exactly. Have you eaten already?
Marco, I know you're a good small talker. Can you give us a few good points?
Yeah, help
hinters,
us. Help us.
Actually, I thought I could learn from you guys, but I was terribly disappointed. but yeah.
You listen to the podcast. What's the takeaway?
I listened to say that it is a personality thing.
Oh, great.
I have to admit, it's not a scientific podcast. It's basically a radio show moderators talking about...
So not a scientific podcast, not like ours.
not like ours, not evidence-based. More rather, it's like their gut feeling in a sense.
And they conclude that
there are differences, right? So I would say like people who are very open to new experiences and very agreeable and are very extrovert might be better small talkers. Having said that, yeah, I don't know. So that's why I asked. I think the complaining or talking about the conference strategy, I would rather focus on the positive elements, like, oh, wow, Copenhagen is such a beautiful city. Or isn't it nice that everyone, like all the divisions are here together?
If you said that to me at a conference, I'd like move slowly backwards. I think you're an absolute psychopath. If someone comes to me and they're like, oh, isn't this all amazing? I'd be okay. time to call the police.
Time to never talk again.
Perfect. And this is the end of our nice little podcast. to be fair, with students, I always start the same way as Philip outlined before. And how's the semester going? And when are the exams again?
Yeah, how was the exam period? Yeah, that's a good one.
That's a good one. Yeah.
Who's your favorite?
Have you made
professor?
Your choices concerning the electives already?
Yeah, I think they are fairly easy to go to. Or do you have any follow-up questions concerning last week? But yeah, with conferences, I still struggle. And I noticed that as we recently had a guest here. And I think that was the reason why my colleague sent me the podcast, because I was just standing there. Nice to meet you.
I mean, but
I had no idea what to ask this fellow because, yeah, never heard his name, read his research, and so on and so forth. So,
Nick, here comes Xena. Nick Berente had like, and I'm not sure if that's just an American thing, but I remember listening to one of the This Is Research podcasts, and he said his go-to is like talking about sports.
This drops into a void with me as well, and then I have to explain them. I don't follow sports.
Yeah, so that's also good because then you know, like, okay, this person isn't worth talking to.
Okay, well.
I feel like you're very good at selecting.
I'm not surprised anymore. You haven't talked to anyone.
I've been in a home office for a long time. You have to understand.
Yeah, it shows.
But we're quickly approaching the 1 hour mark. Yeah. Unless you have any more small talk hot takes for me, how to improve my strategies,
I just
to avoid all social contact.
Practice with ChatGPT.
I feel like it would make it worse. But don't
consult these web pages because I did some Google search before. Uh-huh. And I had questions like, who would you travel the world with?
Oh, yeah.
Or
Okay.
If you would have a superpower, what would it be?
Just and imagine
like, cold. Someone asked me at a conference, I would stare and say,
superpower to disappear. Yeah. Fly away from this conversation as quickly as possible. Yeah, that's just imagine cold opening. What would your superpower be? I should check these websites for the next discussion topic. Of course, in Desk Reject tradition, we have our most important segment at the end that everybody waits for and everybody unanimously loves, and that's the ad segment. Yeah. And today's episode is brought to you by a company that represents the inverse of the favorite brand of Germans, which was, do we all remember? What was the favorite? No.
Aldi.
PayPal. The brand that I would wager all my ape coins might
true.
Be the most despised company. So today's episode is brought to you by I would say maybe the certainly among the top three most despised brands, and let's say it all together at the count of three, two, one, Sanifair. For those of you who have not traveled by car in Germany, in brief, much like payday loan sharks, Sanifair built a business on preying on humans when they are at their most vulnerable, when they have to use the toilet after having driven for hours. To add insult to injury, they spit out a glossy voucher that everybody knows will just end up littering your car, because who wants to be the asshole holding up the line at a kiosk while the cashier manually scans 35 50-cent vouchers to pay for your beefy and a Monster Energy? And I speak in the name of all Germans and of the tens of German tourists when I say I despise you and all you stand for, Sanifair. And to our listeners, for everybody that mails 50 Sanifair vouchers to Utrecht University address to Philipp Becker, we will give you a shout out in the next episode. And that is our ad segment for today. That's top of the mind after having driven for 9 hours through Germany and never fails to enrage me when I'm faced with this Sanifair thing, and then it doesn't read my card and I need to run back to the car and search for coins or I don't know.
If someone actually sends 50 of these vouchers, I would take them, go to a gas station and buy one of these hot dogs that are dispensed in these glass boxes, simmering in sweat for 48 hours, and we'll have one of these.
You heard it here first. That will be our first YouTube content, is Philip eating one of those hot dogs that has been standing there for probably 2 years. With that being said, thank you. Dear listeners, very much for listening. Currently, you cannot follow us on much of the socials. And unless we get a grant, which I believe Philip will be getting soon, this won't change anytime soon. If you do like our podcast, go hit subscribe and remain subscribed on Spotify, on Overcast, on Pocket Cast, on any kind of app that ends in cast. And subscribe every device you have, and tell your mom and your dad about it. They'll love it. They love our lighthearted discussions about how to deal with loss. And intro and outro, the ad music is maybe going to be by our own Philipp Becker. We'll see. If not, it is by Blue Dot Sessions. And this episode was produced by me, Alexander. And until next time, bye-bye.
Tweet.
Our assistant professor Philipp Becker, all the way from Utrecht.
Hi.
Assistant professor Marco Leanderab, all the way from Amsterdam.
Oi.
And myself, Alexander, broadcasting to you from Barcelona. And a new team of hosts means we will also be introducing a completely new revolutionary format in which each week we will be bringing one topic each to discuss, and we will try and incorporate in these topics fucked it up. nochmal.
Free audio post-production by alphonic.com.